Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hello, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Ira Harris. He's an independent trader, successful hedge fund manager, global macro consultant, trading foreign currencies, bonds, commodities, and equities for over 40 years. He was also a CME director from 1997 to 2003. Welcome, Ira.
Well, Richard, thanks for having me. On, at least we have news to talk about. I think we have things of significance.
Yeah. And so I thought we'd begin today with a discussion of what you've been recently writing about on feeding the ducks when they quack. Can you elaborate?
Yeah, you know, it's an old, it comes from the trading floor, of course, where I spent so many years in one capacity or another. And it was always said that when the, you know, when the retail customers came in, or any customers who were buying at the top or at the bottom, or selling at the bottom, so, but most of the time they would come chasing a market, and the tongue-in-cheek attitude was, oh, the ducks are quacking, feed them, give them all they want. It's, you know, it's just a trader's term. It has a derogatory side to it, basically, that the public is always wrong. But, you know, being a foreign currency trader, that wasn't, I learned that that wasn't necessarily the case because, yes, there always has to be a winner and loser, but a lot of times you could be opposite the side of a central bank or somebody doing a massive hedge. So there was room for the public to be more right than the banks, believe it or not. So a big part of the discussions that would go on. But in this regard, as long as the central banks are buying, and this is what I've failed to understand, you know, since the well, we saw it in Japan, of course, far earlier. But once the United States embarked upon quantitative easing, the first blush was actually that the long end of the curve actually yields went higher because people who had hedges were afraid that, well, this massive infusion of liquidity into the system, we're going to have inflation, and it's not inflation, we're going to have greater growth, and that they've stemmed the mass liquidation. So people were actually selling the long end of the curve, and we were getting steepening. But then when they commenced upon more buying, nobody was willing to take on the central bank, the Fed, and there were no sellers. Sellers disappeared because, I talked about it ad nauseum with Rick Santelli over the last 10 years when we would, you know, do our, when he would interview me, and that, you know, there was basically, you couldn't make any money. And then the hedgers disappeared because why hedge? You knew that the bank was there compressing yields, and especially, you know, on this, you know, when they embarked upon QE2, so there became no need to hedge. And as I'm going to write in the blog tonight, I'm going to pick up on Chris Whalen's wonderful piece that he wrote the other day. I have it sitting on my desk. And when you don't have the Fed doesn't hedge. The ECB doesn't hedge because when you have a printing press, what do you need to hedge for? Yeah. You have the ability to create money whenever you deem that you need it. So, you know, why should you hedge? So as Chris Whalen really beautifully talks about, the dynamic hedgers have disappeared from the market, which is, again, another part of the reasons that we are in such a low volatility environment. So my attitude has been, though, when the banks come calling, you have a natural buyer. And that's what I always thought that the Chinese, if they were looking to liquidate some of their treasury portfolios for fear of future inflation, you know, it was time for them to do that. And the ducks are the Fed and all the central banks, and their quacking is when they're buying. So you should be feeding them. And you know what? When they ran the 10-year, and it was the central banks as much as anything that ran the 10-year over the summer down to 1.35, 1.36 again, you know, anybody who needed to unload treasuries should have been unloading them to the buyers that existed. That's the purpose of that wisecrack comment to feed the ducks.
Mm-hmm. And so for 2018, do you see rising interest rates across the entire U.S. yield curve, like, or just simply a steepening with the low end not moving much?
Well, you know, I don't like to make solid predictions like this, but I did in the blog last night because some of the people I've met who are retired successful business people who love to discuss markets, they kind of pinned me down. So I said, so when I look across the board and all the reading that I've done and putting into action really what Chris Whalen talks about as the Fed stops being a, you know, now that they're starting to, as Peter Buchvar so beautifully talks about quantitative tightening. And now there's going to become a break point. And that's when there's no longer central bank adding to the liquidity, global liquidity structure through QE. So now that the ECB is down to 30 billion and the Fed is actually taking out 20 billion a month, and the Japanese, of course, are curtailing their buying. They've been curtailing their buying anyway because there's just not enough paper for them to buy. And so they can have a greater impact as great an impact with buying of far less than they have traditionally been buying. So, or been recently buying, I should say. So I'm looking for the curve to steepen. I think as I read Jay Powell, and I've done a lot of research lately, and going back to the recent release of the FOMC discussions from 2012, I think we'll go to maybe 1.75 to 2% on the Fed funds. But from all he has talked about and his discomfort with the size of the FOMC balance sheet, that you might see them increase Buchvar's quantitative tightening, which will put pressure, upward pressure on the long end of the curve. So, and I don't think that they're willing at this point in time until they really see wage inflation for whatever reason. They're going to hold real yields at neutral, zero. So if inflation is 1.8 and you're at 1.75 on the front, I'm talking about on the short end. So they'll keep those, if they keep the real yield at basically zero, then they'll stop there. And then all the pressure will be for the long end yields to rise. Now, a lot of people say, well, that's going to kill the economy. No, it's not. No, it's not. If the yield curve starts to steepen out, the stock market, I think, will take an original sell-off, but I think that'll be the opportunity to buy back into equities because steepening yield curves are not historically negative equity markets. In fact, they're actually positive because it reflects the fact that, you know, the Fed is kind of at neutral and somewhat accommodative, but not crazy. So, you know what? That's my scenario. And I think, you know, as I said, we're going to go to 3-4. That's my call for the 10-year at the end of the year. Mm-hmm. And if that puts the curve at 1.5, so be it. So be it. And I'm talking about the 2.10. Yeah. So that would be, you know, a fairly steep curve, but not crazy steep. Just like, you know, everybody's screaming about the flattening. And you and I on this show and with many, we've talked about it probably for 2 years already about the flattening and areas that were significant. But if I took a 25-year average of the 2.10 curve, it's probably, last I looked at it, I mean, I do this work periodically, was about 95 basis points. So going down to 50, okay, it's a little flat, but not ridiculous. And if you go to 150, also not ridiculously steep. So that's my call for the year. That's what I'm looking for. And a lot of it is based on the fact that as the Fed starts to do quantitative tightening, there will be more private sector or market participants who are buying, who will have to step into the void to replace the Fed, and they'll have to hedge. So that's, you know, Chris Whalen's wonderful work, is that dynamic hedging will slowly creep into this market and will make an impact on the long end yields.
And will that be an impact that does anything to the bond bull? What are your thoughts on Bill Gross's assessment of the end of the bond bull, likely referring to the 10-year and 30-year bonds?
Yeah, you know, I kind of laughed at Bill Gross. You know, listen, I've been a big fan of Bill Gross. I was a big fan of Paul Macaulay. You know, they did some great works. But Bill Gross wrote a piece 3 or 4 years ago. It was a great, it made the rounds, and it was an interesting piece because anybody who's a global macro trader and a bond, certainly those who partake in the bond markets, Bill Gross wrote a piece after all his turmoil at PIMCO, and when he had first year, you know, he really hasn't done that well, but I have great respect for him. You know, but he hasn't done that well over the last few years, and he's kind of struggled with understanding. He wrote a piece, maybe he was just lucky. Now, I don't believe that. Bill Gross is a very bright guy. But, you know, what did he talk about? It's the end of the bond bull. And then today he's out saying, well, you know, he expects rates to be 2.8 by the end of the year on the 10-year. We're at 2.57 today in the morning, 2.58. 22 basis points with everything that's going on in the world and all the money. That's not much of a call. So that's the way I'm looking at it. Is this the end of the great bond bull? I don't know. I've got a lot of other things that I'll look at, you know, to put this in, because it's all about context. You know, everything is about context. If you don't have context and perspective, you really don't have much of anything anyway. So that's what I'm watching. And I believe me, I have great respect for Bill Gross. I have great respect for Jeff Gundlach as a big thinker. You know, they think now. I think they get Europe wrong. I think they all get Europe wrong because they've never bothered to read The Rotten Heart of Europe. And I handed a copy to Jeff Gundlach when I met him when he was doing an interview with Santelli. And I guarantee you, these people have never read it. And more of the global bond markets will be made in Europe and what happens there than anywhere else. So it's nice that the Fed's stepping back. I think Jerome Powell will look to shrink the balance sheet. I think that's where his comfort zone is. And I think Jerome Powell, as I stated in the blog last night, he actually talks to market participants. Unlike all the governors who seems to be very insular and just a giant echo chamber, and he is a governor, but he seems to want to actually talk to real market participants. And in that regard, I think he's a little leery of the flattening that's taking place. He doesn't want it to continue. And if he really thinks it through, then it's time to really increase the shrinking of the balance sheet. And I think that will get us a steeper curve.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of Europe, where do you see the ECB policies going, monetary policy?
Well, good question. There are things that scare me over in Europe. You know, we talked about the upcoming election. Certainly, the upcoming election, if that doesn't scare you in Italy, and the failure of the Germans to put together a government, these are things that need to scare people because things are not smooth there. And Draghi's in a terrible situation. And again, I will call anybody out on the carpet and anybody who you want to put on and discuss this, you know, because it needs to be debated because these people throw out things. Oh, you know, the ECB has a single mandate. It's inflation. That's baloney. Mario Draghi in July 2012 told you, forget about the inflation mandate. The mandate is securing the existence of the euro currency and the preservation of the EU. That's the mandate. And if you don't understand that, you really need to go and start and lock yourself in a library and start reading and put the perspective together for yourself. That is what this is about. And so what happens now? Yes, in fact, I've got notes right in front of me. Berlusconi is out. And meanwhile, Berlusconi and the Northern League and Five Star, who are not very enamored with the ECB nor with Brussels, are all pushing for various things about, you know, the Italian economy. And Berlusconi was out yesterday talking about a flat tax and how good it will be. So they're all playing off the Trump theme. And but with Italy running 136% debt to GDP ratio, and I know your listeners, you know, in the realm of the Financial Repression Authority understand this, that's an enormous number. That's way beyond Rogoff's, you know, danger of 90% when countries get themselves in trouble. Mm-hmm. And that ratio isn't even shrinking with, you know, at one time this year, I think Italian 10-year yields were down to 1.7%. So the amount of money, the amount of the budget that goes to paying interest rates is probably at a historic low in Italy to covering even that debt because of the manipulated actions of the ECB. Imagine if rates start to go higher there. Mm-hmm. So this is going to be very interesting to watch. But what Berlusconi has basically woken up to, and I've never been a great fan of his, but what he has woken up to with this flat tax idea is he knows that Europe cannot afford to do anything to harm Italy. There's, because of that massive balance sheet that Draghi has built up, and again, who bears responsibility? Who bears responsibility for that massive amount of sovereign and corporate debt on the books of the ECB? Who's guaranteeing it?
The German credit card.
Exactly. And Jerome Powell, of course, you know, told me in the direct question that I asked him over a year ago that, don't worry, they have a printing press. Well, it's interesting because the Italians, who have really been crushed by the euro and this whole situation, they've been crushed because the Italians are famous for making financial mistakes, and they used to be able to bail themselves out, of course, by depreciating the currency, the lira. Yeah. Well, they don't control their currency anymore. That game's over. So now they have to do what, you know, economists will call internal devaluations, which is basically financially repressing worker, because you have to keep wages low because it's the only way you can retain or attain some type of competitive advantage. If you can't depreciate your currency, you've got something has to give, and it's, of course, wages. End of story. I'd be lying to you if I told you I wasn't scared. I am scared. Because Berlusconi is going to force, as I say, he's going to call the question. He's going to call the question. Or he's going to make somebody call the question, and he's going to look them in the eye and go, what are you going to do to us? We saw that you wouldn't let Greece go, that you bent over 1,000 ways. And the Italian situation, being that they're the third largest economy in the EU, it's too big. And the IMF, they blew their wad with Greece. And they have to be very careful here about pushbacks from other parts of the world, because they were not happy that they, in fact, got involved in the Greek situation, because Greece is part of Europe. Europe is a major developed country. What are you bailing out Greece for? It should have been the EU's situation. And Italy's just too big. And Berlusconi, with his flat tax, is basically, to me, in the way that I'm reading it, is calling the question, going, this is how I'm going to stimulate the economy. And if you're going to fight me on it, well, you're going to bear the brunt of, what are you going to do, toss us out? We know you can't do that because you didn't toss the Greeks out. So we get a free run here. So this gets very interesting as we go forward.
But will the German credit card be strong enough to make the EU successful?
Yeah, you know, that is, that is That is the $64 trillion question.
Okay.
It's not even made. $64 trillion. That's the question. Will the Germans stay the course? What will they get for it? You know, it's just a politics. That's why we don't study economics. We study political economy, because this is the politics of the nature. And you see it. You know, Merkel, she gave a New Year's speech, which was a joke. I thought it was my kindergarten teacher admonishing me about something and the way she talked to the German people, and she accepted some of the responsibility. But this goes into what the narrative being spun by the mainstream media, and that's not conspiratorial. That's a fact. I read the FT front to cover. I have for 35 years already. And the spin is that, oh, you know what? The AfD and even the Free Democrats, they did better because people were angry at Merkel for the immigration. That's I call nonsense on that. They're angry because they're the most financially repressed people in the world, because you have 2.5%, maybe 3% growth in Germany. You have inflation approaching 2% in Germany, and you have the 2-year shots yielding negative 60 basis points. Huh? What are you talking about? So they've been getting crushed in the effort to bail out Italy and all the others. So these are all things plaguing Europe. These are all things plaguing Europe. And look at, if the Germans acquiesce, if the German citizens acquiesce and go, okay, we agree to a transfer union, we're running massive trade surpluses and current account surpluses, and we're willing to transfer money to Italy to help them. Let's see. You know what? If they go that route, fabulous. I'll get short so many buns, you won't know what hits you, and I'll buy, you know, other things. But I'm very skeptical. I'm very skeptical. And my skepticism is being actualized by the fact that we're now almost 4 months from the German elections, and Merkel has yet to form a government.
Given the potential in Europe for being the epicenter of perhaps the next financial crisis, as Peter Buchvar mentions, could we see international capital flows come from Europe and elsewhere to the U.S. markets, especially as you mentioned, there could be pressure on the long end of the yield curve with a movement into equities. So, you know, maybe financial crises outside of the U.S. spurring capital flows to the U.S., plus the tax competitiveness that Trump has created with the new tax bill.
You know what, Richard? That was the scenario that everybody painted for 2017.
Okay.
We know never played out for some, you know, I'm not sure, you know, the flow of money into Europe, you know, chasing all of Europe's on the turn, Europe's on the mend. So there was a lot of flows that way. I think there was people who were afraid of Trump. So the funds never flowed into the U.S. But this could be the year. I look at a Euro currency chart, and I have a neutral view to the euro. In fact, you know, as I've been writing about, I think the euro, you know, it bore the angst about Trump and the dollar last year and Trump's trade agenda. So money flowed into Europe. And as I talk about, the euro gained, 13-14% against the dollar, but it also gained 10% against the yen. I think that's a problem for Europe. So I don't think the dollar story is going to be I think it's going to be an interesting dollar story. I think the Chinese are unhappy with the weakness in the yen. I think the Koreans, whose currency is the yuan, South Korea is very strong, are unhappy with the weakness of the forced weakness because of the policies of Kuroda and Abe. So this is going to be, there will be no pure dollar play, but I think the euro, if the euro gets over 123.80, I'll think that the dollar is going to go lower, but on a broad basis. But otherwise, yeah, you know, I think, you know, I don't think the euro is going to do much this year. I'm not looking for a big rally in the euro from here. I think it's kind of played out, and I think it has Draghi concerned, because he does not need a strong euro. He likes to point to the strong euro as a statement about the effectiveness of ECB policies, but that's to placate the Germans anyway, which is a big part of what he has to do. He is on very dangerous ground here, and he knows it, because he fights, you know, every meeting. The last meeting, Jens Weidmann, who's the president of the Bundesbank, who sits on the executive council of the ECB, you know, their voice and their concern, and others are joining too, that the quantitative easing program has gone too far. So this is a very, very difficult time. We'll see what happens. I don't have a big picture. Last year, I thought, as you know, the dollar was going to go lower after I heard, you know, the Trump with the industrialists, especially Mark Fields, who was the CEO of Ford at the time, when he famously said in early February of 2017 that currency manipulation was the mother of all trade barriers. And if you can go from that day on, the dollar reversed course from what it looked like it was going to strengthen, even with the Fed raising, and wound up going lower on the year. So will we go back down there? No, but I think that 123 area, which I will tell you goes back to the range of the week of July 23rd, 2012, when Draghi, of course, made his famous speech about no taboos and we'll do whatever it takes. And that was that low, I think that week it was about 120.70 in the euro, and it wound up closing, I think, around 123.80. I'm not looking at a chart, so I'm doing these out of my memory, which at my age is, but it's pretty close to those areas. So if we get a close, a weekly or monthly close over that 123.80 area, then we're on to new ground. But we'll see.
For 2018, do you see some type of commodity bull market, especially in precious metals and agricultural commodities?
Yeah, it's such a great question. It's a hot topic for a lot of people right now. Yes, I think people are looking to purchase hard assets. You know, that's what we're talking about, because a lot of commodities are deemed hard assets, and they're also used in securitization. It's like the Chinese are so famously good at securitizing copper, whatever. You know, when they're leveraging themselves up, they're securitizing anything and everything. They're almost they're Keynesians, you know, with basically creating a bank core that is supported by global commodities. You know, I think Gundlach is right. I think and others that commodities have been, they've been on the low end of their cycle. So it's now time, and we know that with the, you know, there's going to be a lot of money. Where the velocity of money has disappeared, I'm looking for an increase in velocity as the Fed starts to unwind its balance sheet, because there's going to, this money that was tied up, you know, at the Fed, as the Fed grew its balance sheet because of reserve situations that piled up, these are going to be released. And that's been Ben Hunt, has made that point for the last year and a half, and I applaud him for it. I think there's some there's validity to it. So I think that's playing into the commodity move. We heard this same story last year. Everybody was looking for the Trump inflation. It'll depend. I think I'm watching very closely to see if now Trump proceeds on that path of being able to get a bipartisan deal on an infrastructure program of significance for the U.S. So there's a lot of things in play here. Willy-nilly is, I think, maybe, but I think some of that is like with the Chinese, with their, you know, as we talked about before, when they first announced it about 3 months ago that they were doing the yuan gold oil interesting arbitrage, that helped play it. So I'm not all in on it, but it is interesting to start to see that we're getting some movement in the commodity sector across a broad-based basket.
And your suggestion to the Swiss National Bank would be to sell equities and go into hard assets?
I would say that. You know what? They're sitting on last year. They made their portfolio increased $55 billion with money that was printed in order for them to keep control of their currency. They've printed a massive amount of Swiss francs, which they've converted to other currencies, which then they've bought equities, and they've done so well. So their paper profits, $55 billion last year, equal to 8% of their GDP, all through the creation of money in order to keep the Swiss franc weak, which they've managed it. The Swiss did weaken against the euro last year also by about 10%, even though the Swiss itself held, against the dollar was a little bit stronger. So I don't know when they're going to be starting to move, but I would be looking to swap some of that stuff out. But I know they're caught, because if they do that, the Swiss will gain in value, and they've been trying to prevent that. So there are this. I guarantee you that this will be somebody's great dissertation on what the Swiss National Bank, and you and I and Ronald
Peter Stoll,
I guess you've had on.
Yeah.
Yes. We've had such wonderful discussions about it over the last year, 2 years. You know, I think we've covered the Swiss as well as anybody. In fact, I did see something that came out from the von Mises Institute this morning, really discussing in greater detail everything we've discussed about the Swiss. So I would, if I was a Swiss, I would, for the sake of Swiss citizens, start to be moving out of some of that.
Yeah. And you've granted them the Alchemist Award of the Year, as you mentioned.
Oh, yeah. They definitely get the Alchemist. They are the ultimate cryptocurrency.
Okay. And finally, your thoughts on Larry Lindsay as Fed Vice Chair?
Oh, you're making me go down that path.
okay.
I'm a big fan of Larry Lindsay. I have a lot of respect for him. But Larry, and I respect him for exactly why Trump probably won't pick him, is because Larry Lindsay answers, you know, Larry Lindsay is a bright, exceedingly bright analyst. I went back and read some of his old Fed speeches. In fact, I look at the piece in 1996 when he really was not in favor of, he thought that the Fed, that the markets were already too exuberant, equity markets, and they were doing a disservice to hold rates, even though he voted with the majority. There was only one dissenter, and that was Gary Stern from the regional Minneapolis bank. But he speaks his mind, and he speaks his mind so forthrightly that he even took on the Bush White House when he was a member of that White House as the head of the Council of Economic Advisors, and said that their numbers on what the Iraq war would cost in 2003 were way too low. And, you know, he got sent out into the hinterlands. He was the, as the Jewish people at Rosh Hashanah would say, he was a Zelzel. He bore all the sins of the administration, was sent out to the wilderness. But he spoke his mind, and he proved very prescient, and he was right. So he tells you he speaks his mind. I think that Donald Trump would fear Larry Lindsay as a role, because he's been talked about to be vice chairman, which has usually been a passive role. Donald Cohn was vice chairman to Greenspan, and Donald Cohn is exceedingly bright. No speeches he gave, but he knew his place. The same with Stanley Fisher. Vice chairs, you know, they don't like to buck, but Larry Lindsay, in my estimation, will be a bucker of that. He will not sit quietly, and he will voice his opinion, and it will be heard. And I think that he would overpower Jerome Powell. That's just my opinion. I don't know anything else, but that's what I feel about it. So as much as I would love to see it, I'm at heart a hard money person. I believe that responsible policy is what holds what's needed in a fiat currency world. And I think Larry Lindsay would bring that to the table, but I'm not sure, or, you know, my bias is to believe that the Trump White House is not looking for that type of person. So we'll see. That will surprise me. And I've been right on every Fed pick, by the way. When people were telling Gary about it was going to be Gary Cohn, I wrote no chance. In 2013, when it was supposed to be Larry Summers, I stood tall and said there's no chance it was going to be Larry Summers, because I believed that Lizzie Warren was going to block Larry Summers. And, of course, I believe the triumvirate of Sherrod Brown, Lizzie Warren, and David Vetters, a Republican, blocked the possibility of Larry Summers being the Fed chair. And we got Janet Yellen, which that's not to say I think Yellen played as good a hand as she possibly could with what she was dealt. And I think she's done a very quality job. So we'll see. I've been pretty good with this. So because it's not just economics, it's politics. And let me end by, I'm going to ask you a question, because you're pretty astute. You're very astute, not pretty astute. You're very astute on monetary affairs. So yesterday, the St. Louis Fed put out a paper, a very short paper. The title was, "What does no, that's not the one. I'm sorry. Mixing up my hair. Let's see how far. I know I have it here. Give me 1 second.
Sure.
They talked about the way the Fed board has voted. The St. Louis Fed did a study of the voting of the Fed board. Now, since 2005, okay? Mm-hmm. 2005. Oh, the title of it was FOMC Dissents, Why Some Members Break from Consensus, okay?
Okay.
So they looked at the voting patterns.
Yes.
Since 2005, in what has been a major historical period for central banks, major historical period around the world, but especially with the Fed.
Yes.
How many, I'm asking you, how many dissents have there been by FOMC governors, not regional presidents, FOMC governors to any vote? How many dissents over the last 12 years?
Is it a low number or a zero? What would that be?
Zero.
Right.
Zero.
Okay.
Can we think about that?
Yeah.
Can we think about the power of that?
Yes.
In the most turbulent period of central banking, the amount of dissents by FOMC governors has been zero.
Yeah, that's quite amazing.
That should leave us all speechless. I have nothing else to say.
Yeah, exactly. Well, excellent, good, great insight and words of wisdom from Ira Harris. Ira, how can our listeners learn more about your work?
Again, head to the blog or all the podcasts that I've been so honored to be able to do and to be selected for the FRA, the Financial Repression Authority. I've truly been great. But I blog at Notes from Underground, and it's free. And I don't know, Richard, if you've been all of a sudden, the level of conversation and the responses to the blog is at an amazingly high level.
Oh, that's great. Okay.
I am so honored by that, because the discussion is great. We don't have any wackos. We don't need the comment. And people who read it who have serious questions, and they get serious questions answered, not just by me anymore. The dialogue that has taken place, because I think it's a great statement to, you know, and I talk about in my purpose of writing the blog, it allows me to think and put my thoughts together and put it out there and get feedback from very intelligent people. So it helps my trading in that way.
That's it. Yeah.
And again, so it's not, you know, so many things in this world today are about validation. People need to be validated. That's the problem with social media. You go to be validated. I'm a Marxist. I need dialectical discourse.
Okay. Yes. Excellent.
And we are getting it. People should, and they should absolutely go and buy the Rotten Heart of Europe. Go to rottenheartofeurope.com. It's a website that I control. It's not my book. It's written by the brightest guy on Europe, Bernard Connolly. It's not even close. People need to read this book. Europe is going to be, is going to take center stage in so many different ways. You need to know who the actors are so that you are not blindsided or held captive by a narrative spun by the insiders. Understand what's going to take place there and who's involved. That's what I would say.
Excellent. We'll have a link to that on the transcript on the website.
Great.
In association with the podcast. Also a link to your site and a link to Chris Whalen's article that you referenced as well.
Oh, yeah. And Chris, you know, I sent him an email about how great it was, and it's a great article for thinking.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Ira. Thank you.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.